This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. It's a show full of heroes, fictional and real, on this Veterans Day. An art installation offers a wish for peace as it honors Americans who've fallen in combat.
There's always been a medium in art that's helped show what conflict is and what it does to people. And there's also the healing aspect, the therapeutic quality that art can bring.
Army veteran Bob Carney and others tell Laura Kennedy about the healing cranes of Heartland Community College. Eric Stock talks to veterans about how they reintegrate into civilian society and the reception they get nowadays. The Illinois Symphony Orchestra plans a concert full of superheroes with a salute to veterans. And Darnisha Mitchell tells us about heroes of a different sort, those with autism and those who teach them.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. On this Veterans Day, many Americans are taking time to honor those who served in the military, including those who gave their lives. WGLT's Eric Stock reports public sentiment toward military service has changed for the better in the eyes of many veterans in recent years. Even their own perceptions of service have shifted, and they're more willing to discuss their time in combat.
Tawanda Elementary School's gymnasium filled Friday with the children watching the American Legion Color Guard honor the five branches of the military. This was also an interactive Veterans Appreciation. Children sang patriotic songs and gave small American flags to veterans, families, and friends invited as a thank you. Robert Matherly of Kenny spent 12 years in the Army and had multiple deployments to Germany. He says the military lineage in his family runs deep. Matherly works at a mechanic shop in Bloomington. He's noticed in the three decades since he left the military a greater sense of public gratitude.
Yeah, it's a lot better than it used to be. Everywhere I go, if they know I've been in the military, they always tell me thank you. And yeah, it's changed a lot for the better, yes.
This flag is given in recognition for all the veterans and stuff that have been and served. Please accept it with our sincere condolences.
The American Legion presented Principal Scott Vogel with an American flag folded into a triangle, the tribute to a fallen soldier. Several years ago, he received the flag in honor of his grandfather, who fought in World War II and had recently died. Vogel says the annual Veterans Appreciation precedes his arrival at the school. It's a tradition he's eager to continue. He wants stories of service to pass down from one generation to the next. Vogel admits that's something he didn't give himself the chance to do when his grandfather was still alive.
As I got older, I wanted to know more, but it was one of those things where I was timid in asking questions because I didn't want him to relive situations that he may not have wanted to relive. And now I regret not asking more questions.
Vogel's grandfather was not alone in his reluctance to share military experiences later in civilian life. Ron Rodriguez spent 4 years in the Marines on active duty, then 2 years in the reserves. His niece attends Tawanda Elementary. Rodriguez recently retired from a career in law enforcement, but still helps veterans at a VA facility in Milwaukee and helps prepare military recruits for boot camp. He says the reason most vets didn't want to talk was clear.
I think back in the early days, veterans were not really appreciated as much as they are now.
Much of that sentiment stems from Vietnam, as America struggled to come to terms with a war many didn't agree with waging and that it didn't win. The U.S. remains involved overseas in conflicts with complicated and still uncertain outcomes in Iraq and Afghanistan, America's longest foreign war. But veterans who have served in these wars say they feel much more appreciated. Ron Bonez of Normal has been in the military for 25 years. He served in Iraq twice, and 2 years ago, he was sent to Afghanistan just days before the birth of his second son. With just 3 to 5 years left before he plans to retire, the 47-year-old Bonez says there's a chance he could get deployed again.
I'd probably say 1 in 5.
Ones is an international affairs officer with the Joint Forces Headquarters of the Illinois Army National Guard in Springfield. He says he, too, sees a cultural shift toward how U.S. soldiers are perceived. He dates the turning point to the 9/11 terrorist attacks in 2001.
Prior to 2001, you know, it had been a while since the country had been at war. And then it just ramped up so quickly with both Afghanistan and Iraq and so many service members serving at one time for such an extended period of time, it affected a lot of families.
Nearly two decades after the towers fell, as two of America's longest wars linger to this day, and with U.S. casualties in the tens of thousands and deaths in the thousands, Bones says Americans have learned to separate U.S. policy from the young men and women on the ground who are responsible for carrying out that policy.
Personal feelings aside, their family members or people they know were being deployed. And, you know, agree with it, don't agree with it, still support the people that are doing the job.
Stanton Martin of Normal says he felt he was just doing his job when he was deployed to Iraq near the start of the war in 2003. He was more worried about winning hearts and minds in Iraq than here, as some Iraqis saw the Stars and Stripes as invaders and occupiers. He says spending 15 months dealing with the vastly different cultural norms, including the oppression of women, was a challenge. He was only 22.
Kind of just makes me look at how naive I was back then and the way I looked at the world.
Martin says he was much more prepared for the culture shock 8 years later when he went to Afghanistan. He says it gave him more appreciation for what he had left behind at home.
So when I was over there in a third world country, it makes you realize how good we have it in the U.S. and how a lot of portions of the rest of the world are just completely different.
Martin is now a captain with the National Guard. He is 20 years in. That's a benchmark to get a military pension and benefits. He owns and manages a trophy business at Normal. Martin says he's had to help some military colleagues reintegrate into civilian life, though he is doing just fine. Each of the veterans say the military has done more to provide them with resources when coming home, specifically helping with the medical, social, and emotional needs. Illinois Army National Guard's Ron Bones says it's not always perfect.
Veterans are getting attention. They are getting what they need. Can service be better sometimes? Yeah, I mean, that could be a statement that's made about anything throughout the country, but based on, the past, it's getting better.
National Guard Captain Stanton Martin says he hopes those additional resources will encourage more veterans to come forward to seek help, but some are still reluctant.
I think the biggest part is the stigma of not wanting to speak out, and I think that's the hardest part to get over. So if you are having a problem reintegrating or struggling with something, there's programs there to help you, and the biggest thing you can do is reach out.
Veterans say the greatest asset available to them is each other. They say the camaraderie between fellow soldiers is unlike any connection they will ever have in civilian life because it takes a soldier to understand a soldier. And they want to take advantage of that while they are still around as Vietnam-era veterans die by the hundreds each day. Martin came to that realization when he recently attended the funeral of a comrade.
You know, everyone there I hadn't seen for years, it's a lot quicker to pick up with your battle buddies that you've served with over the years. You know, everyone, you just have such a stronger bond serving and going through a lot tougher of times.
That connection between soldiers holds no matter how many years have passed. Here's Ron Bones.
I don't need to talk to all the people I deployed with day in or day out. It could be weeks, months, even years. But the next time that we do talk, it's like it was yesterday.
And Towanda Elementary Principal Scott Vogel says he hopes veterans keep talking, not just among themselves, but to young people. That's why he thinks school assemblies to honor veterans are just as important as anything students might learn in the classroom.
And sometimes, you know, the parents ask, what'd you learn today? Oh, I didn't learn anything. Well, our goal is when they go home, the parents ask them a question and they're like, yeah, there's something going on today. There was a bugler or whoever was there. And it sparks conversation. They might actually learn that somebody in their family has served in the military or currently serving and be able to have that conversation.
Logo says that's the only way to ensure the veterans' sacrifices won't be forgotten. I'm Eric Stock.
Several McLean County schools are hosting Veterans Day observances today, including Illinois State University and Heartland Community College. The American Legion Post in Bloomington hosted its annual observance this morning outside the McLean County Museum of History in Bloomington.
Support for WGLT comes from the Ecology Action Center, presenting the Sustainable Gourmet Fundraiser November 14th at Epiphany Farms Restaurant, serving local food, sustainably produced wines, and locally crafted beer. Tickets at ecologyactioncenter.org. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, a report from Laura Kennedy on the heroes of veterans and cranes at Heartland Community College. People with autism are often sensitive to outside inputs like loud noises, fast movements, and social interaction. That makes PE class not a great place for many people with autism. WGLT student reporter Darnisha Mitchell tells us about a program for students on the spectrum.
Illinois State University students work one-on-one with school kids ages 5 to 15 in PE class at McCormick Hall at ISU.
There you go.
They start with free time and go into individual workouts with activities. The program is called John's Heroes. The PE program is in honor of the late John Miskelin, a Bloomington native with Asperger's, a condition on the autism spectrum. When John was a student, PE was his toughest class. John's mother, Geraldine Miskelin, says the length of his showers showed how bad his day was. John struggled to find acceptance among classmates. In 2007, these hurdles motivated John to advocate for acceptance of students on the spectrum. At age 14, he created a foundation to inform Bloomington Normal about autism. A few years later, he renamed his foundation HEAL, Heroes Embracing Autistic Lives. He wanted to use his musical talent and passion for children on the spectrum to uplift spirits and encourage them to embrace their unique abilities that set them apart from their neurostandard classmates. John passed away 6 years ago at age 20 from a brain injury. His mother continued his legacy by starting the John's Heroes program. Illinois State University Associate Professor Mary Henninger runs the program. Henninger met John's mother 4 years ago when Henninger asked Miskelin to speak to students.
She talked a lot about how the PE was the worst part of his day and he came home feeling like he was beat up, even though it wasn't physical beating up, and that he would take a shower. The length of the shower every day determined how bad it was. And I thought, teachers can't possibly be doing this, so they must not understand what it means to have autism and to work with a child on the spectrum.
Mary says after that class, she knew something needed to change. Children with autism often experience social, communication, and behavioral challenges. In a gymnasium during PE, students' sensory issues and distractions peak. The flickering of fluorescent lights, equipment constantly moving around, and interaction with peers can be overwhelming for students on the spectrum. Nikki Michalik is a research coordinator for the Illinois Center for Specialized Professional Support. Michalik says the extra help that students receive in John's Heroes isn't provided in a typical PE class.
The instruction that is provided only verbally, and it's not broken down at the level that some of our students might need those tasks or those activities broken down. When we teach a larger skill, we might need to break it down into smaller components, and that's going to look different for each student. So it benefits the students in so many different ways.
Mary continues to preserve John's legacy by emphasizing his message to children with autism, that they are heroes and just what it means to be a hero.
Anybody he met, he was certain that everybody had a superpower. So that's where the heroes came from. Everybody was a hero to him, and he wanted everybody to be a hero in terms of accepting each other.
The heroes receive one-on-one training from one of the college students who are hero leaders in the program. ISU students Anthony Turo and Kira Machieski work at John's Heroes as part of a requirement for the physical education teacher education, also known as PEAT major. Turo says his experience at John's Heroes strengthened his relationship with his students.
Comparing this experience to my other teaching experiences throughout the PE program, I didn't get to develop a relationship with any of my other students. When I was with my student, he made me feel important every day. Every day I knew I had to give my utmost energy, my utmost effort, and match their energy, if not exceed it, in order to make this happen.
For Machieski, she learned to embrace the uniqueness of each student in the classroom.
I think you really start to learn that every student is so different, like their interests or their abilities or the things that they want to do. It really is like different for every student, and I think that's something that we'll remember going into the real world when we get full-time teaching positions, is that no student is alike.
Aaron Beatty, a student in John's Heroes, says he enjoys the one-on-one training from the hero leaders geared towards students like him.
The people are really nice here. They like to learn about autism. One of the other things would be that it's in a gym, which means we have lots of room to run, play, and we have fun activities to do. And we get to have a one-on-one or a two-on-one.
Michalik says that the kids are adjusting well to the program.
I have seen kids who don't enjoy being active or engaging in physical activity put it on their schedule each week and come back excited. They look forward to coming back. They're happy to come back. And that is that whole change in attitude is everything.
Turo says that at the end of the day, it's all about treating students on the spectrum with respect.
Leslie Alex, you go over there.
All right.
Go ahead and back to me.
Michalik adds the program has been a relief to parents who need extra support for their kids. Moms and dads even form relationships with other parents. She says she also wants people to understand despite the social challenges children on the spectrum face, students on the spectrum have the ability to be successful. They can communicate and still have feelings. I'm Darnisha Mitchell.
John's Heroes serves more than 25 kids per year. They range across the spectrum in their abilities. A free class runs Mondays and Wednesdays from 4 to 6 in ISU's McCormick Hall.
Partnering with GLT works for Specs Around Town.
I just feel that the GLT listeners, the audience, are somewhat the influencers in our community.
Hi, my name's Julie Kupsch, and I'm the owner of Specs Around Town.
A GLT underwriter for almost two decades.
Our clients are people that realize the importance of shopping local.
Partnering with GLT works for Specs Around Town. Find out how it can work for you at WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from Zimmerman and Armstrong Investment Advisors, offering securities through First Allied Securities, member FINRA SIPC. Over 30 years of experience, reputable financial management with an independent perspective. Drake Zimmerman has been a proud sponsor of GLT since 1983. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, heroes of another sort, superheroes. An ancient Japanese legend promised that anyone who creates 1,000 origami cranes will have a wish granted by the gods. Years ago, that tradition inspired some local educators to create an art installation that offers a wish for peace as it honors Americans who have fallen in combat. But has the installation itself fallen into shadow? On this Veterans Day, WGLT Arts correspondent Laura Kennedy has more.
High on a wall in the office of the president of Heartland Community College is a grouping of charcoal drawings and a print that all interpret the same subject matter, the origami paper cranes that hang in the Heartland Library. Answering a call from President Keith Corneal to put more student artworks on display, art professor Mac McAvoy assigned his students a project he calls the Grandiose Mundane.
The students are supposed to find an image that's quite ordinary or mundane, and they have to draw it on a large scale to make it grandiose. Not that the cranes were mundane, but they are something that they see every day.
Hanging high in the air, frozen in flight, over the library's books, computers, and studying students are hundreds of carefully folded origami paper cranes. Running almost the width of the library, the flock of cranes are a project that began almost 15 years ago. And although the project has since stalled and the crane's origins are unknown to many students, the birds still have the power to enchant. Art student Ayanna Zachary was excited to be a part of the grandiose mundane project. She says she's always been drawn to the cranes.
I liked not just the visual beauty and interest of the geometry of the paper cranes themselves, but how that related to the same patterns in the ceiling above, and it kept you looking up and it kept your eye moving forward. And so once I learned the history and the meaning behind the paper cranes in that project itself, it was nice because the symbolism and the beauty kind of all came together.
The cranes originally took flight 15 years ago in the early days of the Iraq War. Faculty member Janet Beach Davis heard from advisor Gail Marks about the ancient Japanese legend of the 1,000 paper cranes. Marks says Beach Davis was hoping for a swift resolution to the conflict and so took a pile of white paper and started folding, accomplishing the 1,000 cranes by herself. Cranes, says Marks, are a universal symbol of peace.
It was important to her that she was the one to do it because she felt that anything less than that, the gods wouldn't grant our wish that the war would come to a sudden end.
Not only were the origami cranes an expression of a wish for the war to end, they also represented each soldier killed in the war.
The little white birds are very special. The little white ones are the first ones that Janet folded, and she folded all 1,000.
Looks like there's a date written on them.
That's the date that they died. And then on the other side was their age, and that was real shocking, from how young they were till how old some of them were.
Army veteran Marks engaged herself with writing the information about each fallen soldier onto the cranes. After the creation of the first 1,000 cranes, there was a ceremony on Veterans Day. The project continued, and more cranes were added for the war in Afghanistan. Marks made an effort to engage students in the creation of the cranes.
We'd set it up in the hallway there and have people stop. We would ask them to sign. We would say, would you please sit down and put some of the names and explain to the students while they were going by what they were doing and why.
Soon, many people were involved with creating the cranes, including the Phi Theta Kappa Honor Society. But Mark says the profound meaning behind each crane was too much for some participants.
When it came to writing the names, very difficult to get people to volunteer to do that because it became personal. It was almost as if you knew the person that you were writing their name and their rank on the wing of one of the little cranes.
Each year, more cranes were added to the installation, and each year, a ceremony was held to honor those who fell in service of their country. President Keith Corneal says the cranes are a point of pride for Heartland Community College.
Well, I think it's always important to recognize individuals that have given of themselves for our country, and I think that's what that represents, and it speaks a lot about our institution and their commitment to our veterans.
There is a subset of students who especially appreciate the cranes and what they represent. Army veteran Bob Carney is the program facilitator at the Student Veterans Center at Heartland. He says student veterans look to the crane installation with gratitude.
It's a visual way of showing that they do support veterans. It's kind of in your face, so every time you walk past, you see it. Yeah, it's just a manifestation of what the school is really trying to do in reaching veterans and helping them acclimate back into the civilian world and into the college environment. It's important, yeah, and I think it's nice for the veterans.
But after years of folding and hanging the cranes, the project fell by the wayside. The cranes remained in the library, silently hanging over the heads of students, many of whom were unaware of the cranes' backstory. Then this year, President Keith Corneal's call for more student artwork to be displayed brought attention back to the cranes. A new generation of students began to learn about the Crane Memorial and used it as inspiration for a new art project.
We're currently talking about how we start to build on it again and continue that growth of that display.
And that brings us back to the grandiose mundane. Art professor Mac McAvoy's students acknowledged the importance of the cranes by selecting them as the focus of their group project.
Boy, they've been around here a long time, 15 years, 14 years. So they're very Heartland. Right, and knowing that the new president of Heartland wanted artwork for his office, I thought it was a great way to make that connection. So I was all about the image. I thought it was a wonderful idea.
Like the creation of the origami cranes, the new art project was a collective effort. Art student Ayana Zachary says the results was six unique works tied together with a common goal.
Sharing my voice with the voices of other students and how we each supported each other but had our own identity throughout the whole process. It's something that I think is important in art and life in general, is listening to each other and working together to make something.
When the students' artwork was finished, they got together to talk over what they should call their collective works. Zachary says they drew their inspiration from the cranes themselves and the message they have for the campus community.
And we came up with the Ascension of the Honorable. We were all pulled towards this idea of lifting and elevating and moving upwards.
Gail Marks hopes that this renewed interest will prompt Heartland students to visit the library and pause to gaze upward to the veil of beautiful and solemn cranes.
They want to know where the little birds came from and how they got to be here. Once they find out, the response is pretty overwhelming.
Army veteran Bob Carney says many student veterans are interested in reviving the Cranes Folding Project, and they embrace what it can do not only for Heartland Community College, but for each other.
There's always been a medium in art that's helped show what conflict is and what it does to people. And there's also the healing aspect, where there's been studies shown that military members with PTSD, TBI, just the therapeutic quality that art can bring to their lives, to where it can help heal and also bring some sense of balance. And it's an outlet to get out some of those feelings that they might not be able to share in any other way.
Community members are welcome to explore the Cranes Memorial in the library of the Student Commons building on the campus of Heartland Community College in Normal. I'm Laura Kennedy.
You can see photos of both the Crane Memorial and the artworks it inspired at our website, wglt.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, POW camps in Illinois? Yes, there were. We'll hear more about them in just a few minutes. And now to heroes of another sort, musical and movie heroes. That's the theme for the Illinois Symphony Orchestra concert this Friday in Bloomington. Music director Ken Lamb says movie music is often underappreciated by concert audiences, though instantly recognizable.
The visual and the music kind of really help each other, and some of the composers who write these soundtracks are so good at it that it really adds to the what we're actually watching, and it's, you know, you only have to think of I think the heroes and villains theme is actually a very good example. You know, a lot of these movie soundtracks are iconic. You know, Darth Vader, Superman, Batman, Spider-Man, and then to all the villain stuff, which I actually really enjoy. You know, you've got soundtrack from The Omen. What a classic track! You know, Jerry Goldsmith and Jaws and Psycho. You know, the Bernard Herrmann soundtrack. It just I think it adds to the visual experience.
So I'm told you are a horror movie fan.
Well, I used to be. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think there must be my troubled teenage years or something. And I think a lot of it is because of the music. You know, I you know, who can forget when you see the movie Psycho and that shower scene, when you actually have when Norman Bates came up with a dagger, and it's scary. And it was not until many, many years later that I saw the score. You know, the music sounds like jet like that, and the score, they are not like staccato notes, they are half notes, they're long notes, so they you can see on the page the actual dagger stroke, which is imagined by the composer, which is like, it's frightening, actually, if you look at the page. It's fantastic at the same time.
The music and the film work together, but the music tends to survive on its own afterwards and enter into references. People will hum the Imperial March when they're trying to make a point about villainy. Or
as with every genre, there are lots of mediocre stuff, but there are some really, really good stuff out there that is going to stand the test of time. And I think in this concert, we've tried to pick out the ones that we think have made it into that category. A lot of the John Williams scores are in that category. As you say, you know, everyone's going to be humming Imperial March and a Darth Vader theme and so on. Some of the James Bond music, John Barry's music, it's incredibly iconic. You hear two measures and you know what, you see the character. And then you think about all the villain music also. What do we have here? You know, I think Jaws is one of them. You know, you hear the bum 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 bum. It, you can see it, and but of course, not every piece of movie music is that successful. It takes a real genius to write music like that. That really comes to life.
So, how hard is the music for this concert compared to? A Mozart or a Beethoven or something more in the wheel, in the classical music wheelhouse?
That's a very good question. I mean, you've got to remember when you hear movie music, you're in a theater. And so the movie music is usually scored very heavily for percussion and brass. So the brass and percussion, they're going to get a workout. Now, strings usually sort of give a sort of ambience and the play of the flourishes and so on, but it is difficult in a completely different way than, say, a Mozart or Brahms symphony. In a movie score, there probably is not a whole lot of rubato, especially in the more energetic ones. It usually is very rhythmic and it propels the action forward. And so from that point of view, you know, the challenge is actually to not so much playing together, but actually having the chops throughout the evening to get through everything. It's a tiring show.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Ken Lamb, the music director of the Illinois Symphony Orchestra, about the Heroes and Villains concert coming up late this week. You said earlier that you've tried to pick winners, the ones that either have stood the test of time or that you think will. Why Captain America? Why the Avengers? I mean, I get Batman, I get the Star Wars, I even get Harry Potter, but why the Avengers music?
Well, the Avengers, I mean, you asked a good question because, you know, I made myself watch the Avengers movie.
Was it a chore?
On a plane. it is for a younger generation. You talk to young people, that's what they know. Now, I've also included, like, Godfather in there. I'm just not sure. So what we try to do is to appeal to a wide audience, especially younger folks. And I think that's it's amazing. You hum the Avengers theme, the young people respond, and I think it's just a different time.
And on this Veterans Day, it's worth noting that you're going to be honoring veterans in this concert.
Of course, in the superhero movies, we celebrate, you know, fictional superheroes. But we want to also celebrate our living heroes. And so we played, you know, Captain America and the Avengers, and we also wanted to play Armed Forces Salute, which is actually very relevant, you know, to actually celebrate our veterans and to celebrate America.
The Illinois Symphony Orchestra music director Ken Lamb. He says not only is playing a superhero program a real workout, it's expensive. Because so many of those pieces are still in copyright, there are a lot of rentals for relatively short pieces. But they often require a bigger-than-usual orchestra with more musicians. The ISO offers its Superheroes and Villains program and Veterans Salute this Friday at the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come on the show, a look at some of the most segregated areas of central Illinois and how to fix that. Northern Illinois was home to several German POW camps during World War II. Chase Cavanaugh has more on a Hampshire man who got to know one camp in more ways than one.
In 1944, Hampshire was home to the J.B. Indaradean cannery, which packed local peas and sweet corn. John Fenzel Jr., then a 12-year-old paperboy, overheard the city mayor and farm managers discussing a labor shortage at one of the local restaurants.
And I'm sitting at the counter, and they said, boys, do you know we're not going to have enough help to run this canning factory? What are we going to do? So there was another farmer, and I forget exactly who it was. He says, well, why don't you guys bring in some German POWs?
There were soon tents and barracks, and in April 1944, prisoners from Camp Grant and Rockford came to Hampshire. They included volunteers with the German Africa Corps captured in Libya. More than 200 prisoners worked in the field and cannery, but base authorities wanted to make sure the Germans were kept occupied. That's when the camp's colonel paid Fenzel's father a visit.
Would you be against your son coming into the POW camp twice a day delivering newspapers and at the same time cutting out anything that pertained with murder or rape? Dad said, no, I'm not against it. It'd be a good thing. The kid'll learn something.
And learn he did. Fenzel became well acquainted with Hans Finkel, a POW who ran the camp's PX, essentially a general store. Finkel helped Fenzel with his schoolwork and recounted stories from back home. Eventually, Finkel, who Fenzel said had noticed his fellow Germans were skilled at woodworking, asked the boy if he would help bring in supplies such as sandpaper and varnish. Fenzel said he had a mixed reaction to the request.
Hans, I can't bring carving knives in. And he says, Johann, just take a minute, look on the counter, what do you see? I say, oh my God, straight razors. He says, they have straight razors. If they're going to pull anything, don't you think they'd use straight razors? I said, you got a point.
Fenzel agreed to bring in the supplies and was paid in Hershey bars and tobacco products that he could sell at his father's garage. Among Fenzel's mementos from that time is a wood carving by POW Ludwig Kafka, an aircraft mechanic who made the piece out of part of an orange crate. It contains photos of Fenzel at a young age and the motto, Bete und Arbeite, pray and work. Fenzel says the POWs were quite religious and made their way every Sunday to the local Catholic and Lutheran churches. Once the services let out, Fenzel said something special would happen.
Whatever church let out first, they would meet in the center of town and they would sing, give you a concert, like Lily Marlene and Silent Night in German.
After the war, Fenzel enlisted in the army, and in the mid-1950s was deployed to Germany to defend against a possible Soviet advance. Fenzel said he tried to reestablish contact with Hans Finkel and Ludwig Kafka, but army duties kept him from being able to see them out in Berlin or Vienna. Fenzel said he was able to meet Finkel's family in the 1990s, after the Berlin Wall came down, but Finkel had unfortunately passed away a month prior. Later, in 2005, Fenzel was able to get in touch with Kafka's daughter, but he said she didn't initially believe his story about Kafka's life in the POW camp. She asked Fenzel to identify her father in a family photo.
Mr. Fenzel, Herr Fenzel, pick out Ludwig. I did. I said, I'm Papa. And then she hugged and kissed me. She believed me finally, because she couldn't believe that he would be involved in stuff like that.
There's little trace of the camp left in Hampshire, so Fenzel has become a de facto expert on the subject. He said Germans regularly inquired about the camp.
I had two U-boat commanders come and talk to me. And I had to show them everything. And they couldn't believe that we treated prisoners like we did.
Fenzel continues to tell his story and said the cordial experience in Hampshire between the POWs and Americans hints at something greater.
We're all body and soul, so to speak, and you know, they're the same as we are in a way. You take away some of this outside response that they have or this outside action that they perceive or put forth. We're all the same when it comes right down to it.
I'm Chase Cavanaugh.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Earlier this year, reporters from Governing Magazine laid down a mammoth investigative report showing that some mid-sized cities in Illinois are among the most segregated in the nation. The causes are many. The cures are difficult. Change would take generations, even if communities pulled together to address the issue. Most experts agree change must be incremental. Minorities make up a disproportionate share of the lower-income population in most cities. Cheryl Boswell of Peoria is a past board member of Housing Action in Illinois. Boswell says to get at segregation, cities such as Peoria and Bloomington Normal should require new multi-unit developments to have an affordable housing component.
How do we move the needle forward with policy that would help when policies come in place and they do housing, that there are some set-asides or some requirements in the development that so many of those housing or units will have to be for low income.
Boswell grew up being bused from the south side of Peoria to school in an effort to desegregate schools. A generation later, Peoria schools are still very black or very white, depending on where they are. She said city infrastructure decisions affect that.
Oh, it matters 100%. One of the worst things that I believe that happened in the city of Peoria was the urban renewal that came through here in the late 60s, early 70s. It broke cultures, it tore up neighborhoods, it totally changed communities that were on the south side of Peoria.
She says revitalization to develop blighted areas must build communities and not just talk about how old the housing stock is. To do that, Boswell says Peoria has to invest in infrastructure, streets, sewers, and make it easier to develop housing, which in turn creates a property tax base.
When you look at the migration of the population out of the city, those are revenue dollars that the city lost. Somehow, we have to get revenue back into the city, and I think housing is a way to do that.
She thinks the city should find ways, in addition to tax credits, to make development easier. There's an even more macro issue that encourages segregation in Peoria, Bloomington Normal, Springfield, and any other traditionally structured city. It's zoning. Anne Hotelling directs Hope Fair Housing, which serves 30 counties in northern and north central Illinois. She says the first time we had zoning was in the 1920s, and the origin is racist.
That's the first time we started to see zoning, and it started to segregate people. It was designed to have these single-family areas that would be exclusionary and exclude people of color from the communities.
Hotelling says cities can counter this now by being more inclusive in rental housing requirements to promote mixed income areas. But she says there is an economic case for broader use of the tool as well. For instance, when a municipality considers moribund commercially zoned strip malls for redevelopment, Hotelling says rezoning from mixed use helps in a number of ways.
If you reimagine that as retail and commercial on the bottom, restaurants and the dry cleaner and the cell phone repair store and housing above, then you have the housing, but you also have a built-in market for the stores below. And you're retaining that income in the neighborhood, and you're also helping to integrate it at the same time.
In fact, that's the way a lot of cities and towns looked in the 1800s and early 1900s, and Hotelling says they could again. As cities approach redevelopment, they have to decide where to put their markers. Everywhere at once or in specific areas. This is a political issue for any representative council, how to share out scarce assets. But City of Urbana grants manager Sheila Dodd says there's a case for using redevelopment incentives and funds in a concentrated area until you get results. One of her previous jobs was director of Habitat for Humanity in Champaign-Urbana. Dodd says they used money from the housing foreclosure lawsuit settlement and an Illinois Housing Development Authority grant to tear down 10 homes in a blighted 8-block square area in Urbana and build new ones. And results happen fast.
And in like a 4-year time period, we saw assessments at a minimum go up $2,000 and some even more than that. And in that older housing stock neighborhood, that's huge, you know, to see that investment go back in, families start to move back in. It's a nice mix of seniors and younger families, and they kind of help each other out.
Dodd says not only did the neighborhood stabilize, diversity increased. And with people moving in, she says it's now worth additional city resources to improve infrastructure.
They have taken a look at that neighborhood and are going to be putting in sidewalk ramps and investing in the new street overlays and sidewalk repairs that need to be done.
And Dodd points out better streets and sidewalks will, over time, improve housing values as well. Another reason to concentrate a city's redevelopment effort, Dodd says, is pure public perception as available federal and city dollars shrink.
Really, for people to feel like the city of Urbana cares and they really are investing in their community, we need to have that more concentrated area of focus as much as we can.
By focusing on a single tight geographic redevelopment area, Dodd says, it's easier for other agencies and arms of the city to coordinate efforts in that same territory, such as rehabs, social service funding, and leveraging grants. On a smaller scale, affordable housing tends to be in clusters, and those clusters can perpetuate segregation. Some people qualify for housing choice vouchers to help with rent. Those are supposed to be portable anywhere in a city. Landlords are not supposed to turn down people with vouchers because they are low income. Studies show property owners often discriminate anyway. Naperville and some other entities such as Champaign and Cook County have fair housing ordinances on top of federal rules. Ann Hotelling of Hope Fair Housing says a number of people inside and outside Naperville city government came together to take on this issue.
We at Hope Fair Housing Center were receiving complaints from people, veterans with disabilities, who were turned down from renting because they had a housing choice voucher, and were getting a response from the city that they weren't sure that their source of income ordinance included housing choice vouchers. And so there was sort of a groundswell of people not being able to access housing in Naperville.
Now, in many communities, Hotelling and other housing experts say community organizing is something of a lost art. She says there is plenty of anger and motivation, but less of the careful education, coalition building, and stakeholder involvement that affect real change. It's not easy or quick work. Hotelling says in Naperville, the group pushing voucher anti-discrimination provisions did that work and even found landlords in the upscale community to lobby for the measure because they came to see vouchers as desirable.
If somebody loses their job, the housing authority picks up the rest until they get another job and they're able to contribute to the housing. And so it's a guaranteed stream of rent for the landlord.
A second reason property owners should like housing choice vouchers, Hotelling says, is that the tenants tend to be more predictable than the general public.
You know, people wait for years and years. There's not enough assistance to go around for these housing choice vouchers. People wait, and then they finally get them, and they treat it like a winning lottery ticket. They are very good tenants who follow the rules and maintain the property because they want to make sure that they can have the housing assistance as long as they need it.
She says any community needs someone to herd the cats and keep the conversations going until policy measures emerge. Bloomington, Normal, and Peoria do not have such voucher choice anti-discrimination measures in place. But Hotelling says segregation and discrimination happens at all economic levels, too. And while housing voucher choice and anti-discrimination measures might move the needle on segregation, she says residents also have to be aware of their own tendencies to self-segregate. When people go to find a house or condo or an apartment, they look partly based on the job, the commute, and the quality of the area. But Hotelling says people tend to seek out advice from people they know to help shape the search.
Your social networks, because we're segregated, our social networks are segregated. And so when you tap your social network for where you're going to live, you're already tapping into segregation and the cycle continues.
Hotelling says changing policy at the top is important, but as individuals, we can also choose to integrate our own social networks. She says if cooking, biking, knitting, or book group is your thing, you can work to integrate those groups so that when housing decisions come up, your social network will be as diverse as the city in which you want to live. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories, which today came from Eric Stock, Darnesia Mitchell, and Laura Kennedy. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Let's go out with the Stars and Stripes. On this Veterans Day, you can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.